It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report from the Fed estimates that tariffs put in place by the Trump administration are costing U.S. consumers more than $1 billion a month. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, as we head through the afternoon, how's your energy level? Are you feeling pretty good or are you starting to drag? A new global study from Philips shows that most people aren't getting enough sleep. In fact, 62% said at best they only sleep somewhat well, and 80% said they want to improve their sleep quality. And the effects can go beyond just feeling tired. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, sleep deprivation has a high correlation to depression, obesity, stroke, and even cancer. So what's keeping us from getting the sleep we need? And what can we do about it? Dr. Lisa Cottrell is a clinical health psychologist with Aurora Healthcare in Grafton. She specializes in the behavioral and psychological treatment of sleep disorders in adults, adolescents, and kids. Dr. Cottrell, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
It seems clear that we are living in a sleep-deprived society. Is that anything new?
Well, it's been around for a while, but it does seem to be getting worse.
And do we have any idea why?
Well, there are many reasons. There are, of course, many more electronic devices to keep our attention and to disturb our ability to sleep. Of course, work hours take a toll, and the way we socialize, again, with electronic devices is having a negative effect on how we sleep and when we sleep.
So let's dig into some of those reasons. Let's talk about electronics, because certainly, as you said, this is a newer development in how we live in our society, how we connect, how we entertain ourselves. What is it about those electronics that can lead to poor sleep?
Well, there are actually several things. So the one thing that people often think about first is that they emit blue light. And blue light does disturb our circadian cycle, and that can keep us alert when we'd like to be actually falling asleep. Another factor is that the things that we do on these devices tend to be really activating. So we get involved in activities on the devices, and that can make it hard for us then to settle down and be able to fall asleep.
So I think sometimes we think like scrolling through Facebook or just kind of noodling around looking at things that that's really pretty passive. But you're saying that it is actually still mentally stimulating, even if it's maybe not anything, you know, it's not like studying for a math exam or something.
Absolutely. If you talk to people about that, you'll find often they'll say, you know, all of a sudden it's been an hour and a half and I don't know where the time went.
And is that also tied to, you know, a lot of people now, instead of watching a movie or a TV show on a TV, they're actually watching it on their phone or maybe on a tablet, or maybe they're in bed and watching it on a TV.
Right. Many people do have their phone or their tablet or laptop in bed with them, or a television in their bedroom.
What is the recommended amount of sleep that, say, let's just say an adult, you know, middle-aged adult should be getting every evening, every night?
So adults need somewhere usually between about 7.5 and 8.5 hours of sleep a night.
And that Philips survey that we referenced said adults on average are getting about 6.8 hours of sleep a night. Not a huge difference from what you said, but does that spell trouble to you?
Oh, absolutely. People report regularly getting less than 7 hours of sleep, and anything less than 7 hours of sleep on a consistent basis is associated with many negative health outcomes.
What are some of those negative health outcomes?
So, of course, increased risk for obesity, increased risk for heart disease, increased risk for depression, and actually diabetes, and even cancer.
Do we know what the correlation is between those very serious health conditions and something that seems, you know, not that big a deal, getting less sleep than we should?
Well, when we don't get enough sleep, then our bodies aren't doing the things they need to do during those hours we should be sleeping that help take care of our health. One really obvious and clear example we found is that when we get inadequate sleep, some of the hormones in our body that regulate eating and hunger get out of kilter. And then that affects, for example, our eating habits and the way even our bodies are able to manage food intake.
There are some people who say that they really don't need that much sleep. They can get by on maybe like 5 hours a night. Is it possible that there are some human beings that that's the case for?
There are some human beings who are what we call short sleepers. Very, very, very few. A very, very small percentage of the population. And usually what we would consider a short sleeper would be someone who, for whom 6 hours is adequate. But that is very rare.
I've also heard it said that older people, that as we age, we need less sleep. Is that true or is that a myth?
That's not really true. We need less sleep as adults than we do as teenagers. But once we're adults, the amount of sleep we need stays fairly constant. The older we get, the more we tend to wake up during the night. The way that our sleep happens over the course of the night does change as we get older. And so that can certainly have an effect on how much an older person will sleep during the night. And it can reduce that somewhat. But that doesn't mean that we need less sleep. So we still need to do well and to have optimal health outcomes, approximately the same amount of sleep.
We're talking with Dr. Lisa Cottrell. She's a clinical health psychologist with Aurora Healthcare in Grafton. She specializes in the behavioral and psychological treatment of sleep disorders. And we're talking about the fact that as a nation, we don't get as much sleep as we need. And Dr. Cottrell, I wanted to zero in on something. We're talking about amount of sleep, but does it also matter when we get that sleep? Because there are people, for instance, that either work, work an overnight shift, sleep during the day, or people whose schedules change. And sometimes they're working that third shift, sometimes they're working first. Is that an additional barrier to getting all the benefits of good sleep?
Yes, it absolutely is. So first off, we all do better when we have a consistent sleep schedule. But it also does appear that people who work night shift, even when they do stay with that kind of schedule 7 days a week, tend to have some poorer health outcomes than people who work first shift. In any case, we do have a time in our body clock that is a good time for us to be sleeping. And again, the more consistent we are able to be with when sleep happens, the better quality of sleep that you'll have.
What about if, say, we're watching TV or relaxing, maybe reading before bed, after dinner, we fall asleep on the couch for maybe an hour, and then we go up, you know, go to bed and finish off our night's sleep. Is that total amount of sleep the same as having it uninterrupted?
Probably not. If you're sleeping, for example, in front of the television, that having the television in front of you while you're sleeping is actually going to disturb the quality of your sleep that you're getting during that time. And depending on how much disruption you have when you get up and you get into your bed, that's going to disturb the quality of your sleep as well.
You mentioned earlier that adults need overall less sleep than younger people. How much more sleep do children and adolescents need?
Well, so elementary school age children typically need as much as 11 hours of sleep a night. Generally, we think between about 9.5 and 11 hours. And adolescents and teenagers need between about 8.5 and 9.5 hours of sleep a night.
We're talking with Dr. Lisa Cottrell. She's a clinical health psychologist with Aurora Healthcare in Grafton. And we're talking about what keeps us from getting a good night's sleep and what we can do about it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble sleeping? How have you done Have you done anything to try to improve the quality of your sleep? And how does your lack of sleep affect you throughout the day? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're talking about how to get better sleep. Dr. Lisa Cottrell is our guest. She's a clinical health psychologist with Aurora Healthcare in Grafton, and she specializes in the behavioral and psychological treatment of sleep disorders in adults, adolescents, and children. Tell us about your sleep habits at 800-642-1234. Would you say you sleep pretty well, or do you struggle? What have you done to try to improve your sleep quality? Have you seen a doctor, for instance? If you consistently get a good night's rest, tell us your secret. What questions do you have about falling asleep, staying asleep, sleep disorders, or naps? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Cottrell, I wanted to ask about the idea of catching up on sleep. So another recent survey said that another recent study said that catching up on sleep over the weekend isn't a very healthy thing to do. So people during the week are not getting enough and then they try to make up for it on the weekends. Why doesn't that work or why is it problematic?
Well, if you sleep in on the weekend, one of the things that happens is that that body clock I talked about before does tend to shift a little bit, and that can create some problems when you get back to the week with having the time that you'd like to fall asleep be lined up where you want it to be and then be able to wake up when you want to be able to wake up in the morning. It will also potentially disrupt what your sleep looks like at night if you sleep in the morning.
Let's go to the phones, and Marie in Menominee Falls is up. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I usually sleep only about 4 hours a night, but I feel great during the day. But then after a couple of weeks of doing that, then I'll just like crash one day late in the afternoon and I just kind of make up for that time, and you might have kind of answered this, but is that possible to make up that missed sleep?
And I did want to go to you, Marie, because Dr. Cottrell had just been talking about that. Marie, is there any way to not only get 4 hours a night, or is that just the way your schedule is?
No, that's just me. I try to go to bed, and I'm the only one up. I'll go to bed at midnight. And then I get up at 4 a.m. That's it.
So Dr. Cottrell, what would you say to Marie? It's not that she doesn't have the time to sleep. She just can't stay asleep.
Well, it's possible that she does have some kind of a sleep disorder that's contributing to this pattern. And if that's true, then it can happen that people get into habits of how they sleep that can just perpetuate that pattern. So it might not be a bad idea to meet with a sleep specialist to see what's happening with that. You really can't over time make up for lost sleep. It certainly is possible if you have one night during which you didn't get quite as much sleep as you ought to. If you have a really short nap in the middle of the day, that might help to make up that sleep from the night before. But in terms of a long-term plan, we don't find that really helps helps to make up that lost sleep.
Thanks for that call, Marie. And let's go now to Bryce in Cudahy. Hi, Bryce.
Hi. I was just wondering, because I heard you mention that watching TV and then falling asleep is bad because it impacts sleep quality. I've always slept with either like a fan or a white noise machine. Does that impact your quality of sleep or does it have any effect?
Thanks for that call, Bryce. So, Dr. Cottrell, is that a way to kind of control our environment?
Right. So a fan or a white noise can actually be a really good way to manage other noise that might be in the environment. And so having white noise or a fan on while you sleep is actually a really good strategy for many people to provide them with a more evenly quiet sleep environment.
We're talking with Dr. Lisa Cottrell. She's a clinical health psychologist with Aurora Healthcare in Grafton, talking about how to get a good night's sleep and why it's important. And Dr. Cottrell, one thing I think is fairly common is that if we often have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, it can actually become a stressor in itself, worrying about whether you're going to get a good night's sleep or not, and setting yourself up for not getting one because you're so worried about it.
Absolutely, that's true. So when people start to develop trouble sleeping, then they might very well get anxious about not sleeping, which of course isn't really going to soothe you to sleep at night when you're thinking about it. So you're right, getting more anxious about sleep does tend to make the sleep problem worse. It's much better if you do have a bad night that you're able to recognize that, you know, you might be okay during the day. It was just one night. And in that way, you'll reduce that possibility.
I've heard the term sleep hygiene used in kind of making sure that our environment is as conducive as possible. Can you talk about some of the things that we can do to make the place where we're sleeping the best place it can be?
Sure. So it's really good to have a very dark sleep environment. That's going to set you up for a better opportunity for good quality sleep. Of course, you want it to be quiet. And you also want to pay attention to the temperature in your sleep environment. Really, generally speaking, cooler is better. So there is some disagreement about the perfect temperature, but generally speaking, it looks like somewhere between about 60 degrees and 67 degrees Fahrenheit as an ambient room temperature seems to be best. You, of course, want to have a comfortable place to sleep and have a really regular sleep schedule, especially have a very regular time of getting up in the morning so that you really do avoid sleeping in on the weekends so that your body clock is set to know when the right time is for sleep to happen.
Let's go back to the phones, and Kim in Sauk City is up. Hi, Kim.
Hi, I wanted to make a comment that the amount of Wi-Fi and the sort of low-level microwave radiation in our society today reduces the amount of melatonin in the brain, and that's so important for sleep. I notice when I'm around towns a lot and just, you know, in environments where I'm exposed to a lot of that Wi-Fi, I have quite a lot of trouble sleeping, but when I go out into the country and I get away from that, I can sleep through the night extremely well.
Thanks for that call, Kim. Dr. Cottrell, is that something that's been studied?
Not that I'm aware of. So I'm not aware of any research that addresses that specifically. But I certainly do know that there is research that shows that light exposure or blue light exposure, which of course is potentially connected to the Wi-Fi as a device, does in fact affect the way that melatonin is regulated in the body.
Dr. Cottrell, as we said in this recent survey, as many as 80% of people wish they could sleep better. At what point should we consider going to see a sleep specialist if we are really not sleeping well?
So, of course, if you snore and you feel like you're sleepy during the day, it would be a good idea to check with a sleep specialist, a sleep doctor, to see if you might have some kind of a sleep-related breathing disorder that's disturbing your sleep. If you regularly have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, or you regularly wake up much earlier in the morning than the time that you're planning to get up, so if that happens two or three times a week with regularity, then that might indicate that you have a sleep disorder. And again, if you're feeling like you're extremely sleepy or having difficulty staying awake at different times of the day, then it's worth checking to see if your sleep is what it should be.
Listener Alec in Sun Prairie wondered whether it's more helpful or harmful to sleep with pets, and I know a lot of people do. What are your thoughts as a sleep specialist?
Well, as a sleep specialist, I have to say that most of the time, sleeping with pets is more likely to disturb your sleep than help your sleep. I know, though, many people who do sleep with their pets feel that that's not something they want to give up.
And before we wrap up, Dr. Cottrell, any last thoughts on how important sleep is and what we can do to get better sleep?
Well, I think really just being aware of the importance of sleep is the first step, and actually starting to structure your day to plan for what your sleep will be like at night. Don't make it the least important part of your day. It really should be the most important part.
So maybe take a look at your schedule, what you're doing in the couple hours maybe before bed?
Absolutely. It's a great idea if you're able to do it to have at least an hour or two before the time you'd expect to go to bed to wind down and relax, really just get off those devices and allow yourself to do something that's really nice and relaxing.
Well, Dr. Cottrell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. You're very welcome.
Dr. Lisa Cottrell is a clinical health psychologist with Aurora Healthcare in Grafton, Wisconsin. She specializes in the behavioral and psychological treatment of sleep disorders in adults, adolescents, and children. She joined us to talk about how important a good night's sleep is and ways that we can get it. And you can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us what tricks you have or habits you have to make sure that you get a good night's sleep. If you're having trouble sleeping, tell us what seems to be the problem or ask for advice. And let us know if you have found the secret to getting a full 8 hours of sleep. A new report released by the Federal Reserve Bank in New York found that trade policies and tariffs put in place by the Trump administration cost Americans roughly $1.4 billion per month by the end of last November. According to the report, consumers were hit with a 1-2 punch. First, imported goods, not surprisingly, were more expensive. And second, there were fewer products overall to choose from. Our next guest is here to break down the report and update us on the latest conversations about trade and tariffs. Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
So was this news a surprise to you as someone who's been following this trade news closely?
No, actually, one of the nice thing about this, the sort of hit to the U.S. economy is not nice, but the nice thing is it confirms how we think about the sort of economics of international trade.
Right? So you would have expected these kind of numbers.
Not, the specific magnitude was always open to question, mm-hmm. but these patterns are very clear. Right? So when we think about trade, free trade benefits consumers by lowering the price of goods and increasing the variety of available goods. And so when you impose tariffs, you're reversing both of those effects. And we would expect to see that in the data as we have.
So help us break this down a little bit. $1.4 billion per month certainly sounds like a lot. What exactly are we talking here? What kind of impact is that?
Yeah. So the U.S. economy is trillions of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you say this is a large nominal number. And on the other hand, it's relatively small when you think about the U.S. economy as a whole. And that sort of tells us actually a little bit about the politics of trade is we all benefit on a lot of different products that are imported from China and elsewhere that are a little bit cheaper. Mm-hmm. Right? When you put up 15 or 20% tariffs, but you're talking about a $25 product or something like that, on any individual good, you don't really notice. Right? And so you aggregate it up. The people who really notice are import competing firms in the United States, right? So part of this is the steel and aluminum tariffs from last year. And so American producers are protected from foreign competition. And so there's a big direct benefit. But the aggregate welfare hit is in all of us as consumers, and consumers, you're really thinking about two groups. There's you and me, mm-hmm. right, when we go into stores and we're buying things. But then there's firms that are importing inputs into manufacturing. Right. And in fact, with a lot of these tariffs, the solar panel tariffs, the steel tariffs, the aluminum tariffs, you're talking about American companies that are importing these inputs into their production process. And so they're the ones that are taking the really big and more noticeable hit.
So these tariffs are being put in place on goods that are being imported mm-hmm. into the United States. And President Trump said this was to kind of level the field that had not been fair before. But if prices are going up, who is actually paying for those tariffs? Is it the foreign manufacturers or is it the U.S. consumer?
Yeah, no, it's Americans are paying the tariffs, right? So the way tariffs work is there are taxes on goods at the border. And the person who pays the tax or the corporation that pays the tax is the actor who is buying the good from overseas, right? So the rhetoric from Trump and the administration is that we are now getting lots of money from China in the form of tariffs. But what you're actually doing is you're raising the cost of goods. And so it's American consumers and American firms that are paying the taxes. One of the really interesting things from the report is almost all, if not all of that has been passed directly through to consumers. Right. So you could imagine firms could say the inputs into production have gone up by 25%. We're only going to raise prices at home on our goods by maybe 10% and we'll take a little bit of a hit. But what I've seen in the report is almost all of that 20 or 25% has gotten passed through to American consumers.
So are these tariffs having the intended impact in that case?
Well, it's hard to know what the intended impact is, right? So I'm a political scientist, and you think about the politics of this and the economics of this. The president is able to say he's doing something about China. He is also imposing economic costs on a lot of people who supported them. So there was another report that came out from the World Bank that showed that most of the hit, not just the U.S. tariffs, but the retaliatory tariffs, right? So the Chinese and others have put tariffs on soybeans and American goods now. And that has fallen primarily on regions of the country that supported Trump in 2016. So on the one hand, you have politically the president is able to say, I'm doing something, and there's a story about, redressing unfairness in the global economy. On the other hand, the material hit is actually taking place on his political supporters. And that's sort of people vote for lots of reasons, right? You know, not just material reasons, but also other identity-based reasons. And when we think about the politics of trade, there's lots of variables aside from the actual economic hit that might lead you to support these policies.
We're talking with Mark Koplovich. He's a professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about new research that shows the dollar amount cost to American consumers of the current tariffs that are in place. And Mark, before we move on, one of the other part of that is that we're seeing less variety in consumer products. Why is mm-hmm. that an aftermath?
Well, so if you're thinking about firms that are importing, retailers that are importing goods from overseas, and what are you going to sell, you're paying. Tariffs are very specific. There are tariffs which are all goods coming from some countries, right, would have a 5% tariff. But the tariffs we're talking about here are product-specific tariffs. And so the more variety of products you're importing, you're paying a tariff as an importer on each one of those goods, and you're passing the costs on for each one of those goods, or you're absorbing them to keep prices lower for consumers. So I think one of the things we're seeing is consumer behavior might be changing and shifting to buy more domestically produced goods. But the other thing is importers are bringing in fewer varieties because they don't want to pay the full range of tariffs at the border. So you see that. You see the direct hit. You see the variety hit. You also see what we talk about with the economics of trade known as deadweight loss, which is there's broader inefficiencies in the economy now because if you're paying more for inputs to production and consumer goods, then you're not using that money for savings and investment. So you get broader spillovers in the economy.
We have a caller, Owen from Wyawega, is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Owen.
Yeah, hi. I'm curious to know, after these tariffs get reduced or taken off, are the consumers going to see a savings as a result, or have we just taught the producers of these goods and services that we've had tariffs applied to that they can charge that much more for a product and the consumer's still willing and able to pay for that? And are they just going to continue to charge us what they've been charging? Like, I buy tires, for instance, and we've seen a 22 to a 40% increase on tires for the farm. And I just wonder, is those tires ever going to come back down? Because I'm buying tires from places that I didn't even think had tariffs that they're saying the prices have gone up on due to tariffs.
Thanks for that call, Owen. Really great question.
Yeah, it is a really great question, actually. I think the answer is yes, they will come down. The question is about the sort of timeline for that, right? You know, if the tariffs are reduced and products are available from parts of the world at cheaper rates, eventually people are going to shift their consumption behavior and firms are going to be able to import those goods. But it's an open question on to how long that might happen. There's also a question now about the credibility of the United States to free trade. Right? So you could imagine firms and consumers and other countries might hedge their bets and say, well, Trump might get rid of these tariffs, but he might put other tariffs in over the next couple of years, and we're going to wait to change any behavior now and see what the new status quo is. And one of the problems is we don't control some of those tariffs. So the tariffs that have been put in place by the U.S. government could come off. The retaliatory tariffs might stay for a little longer for this reason about concern about what's coming next down the pike.
Mark, we're talking a lot about especially the tariffs and retaliatory tariffs with China. The president, throughout his whole campaign and as president, has been against the original NAFTA deal, the North American Free Trade Agreement. He did renegotiate that with Mexico and Canada. Where is our trade balance with those two very close trade partners?
Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact numbers. I know we're running, I believe, a trade deficit with both countries.
And that means what for us?
We are buying more imports than exports, right? So we are buying more from Canada and Mexico than we are selling. The balance of payments of a country has two sides, though, right? So you have the current account, which is the trade side, and you have the capital account, which is the financial side. And overall, at the end of the day, those things need to balance. And so there are net inflows of investment from Canada and Mexico into the United States. So it's the president really likes to focus on who's winning in trade as a function of whether the country has a trade deficit or not. It's not really the way we think about the economic health of the country. Because to some extent, if Mexico and Canada are producing goods that are cheaper than we can produce them, we should be specializing in something else. And in the United States, that often means things that are more high-skilled manufacturing services, financial services. And so, you know, if you look at the trend since World War II, there's a downward trend in manufacturing in the United States, and we're just a very different economy now than we were 50, 60 years ago. So there's a lot of rhetoric about raising tariffs and changing the U.S. back into a manufacturing economy. That sells politically, but it's really hard to see how that's going to happen. And there's a lot of structural things also about the U.S. issues the dollar, which is the global reserve currency. And if everybody wants to hold the dollar, that means that money is coming into the U.S. on the financial side. And almost by definition, you have to run a trade deficit.
And Mark, as we wrap up, we're heading into the 2020 election year. Do you see these trade wars and issues impacting how people view President Trump and his competitors?
Yeah. Let me say a couple of things. So one is, as we were talking about, that a lot of the hardest hit groups and individuals are in places that supported Trump in 2016. And so then it's a question of how people are weighing things like their material economic interest relative to identity, race, religion, social issues, those sorts of things. But, you know, when you read the news, it seems like there are a lot of people now in the states that Trump won in 2016 who are less happy than they were. That could show up in changing their vote. That could show up in reduced turnout. The other thing is, you know, you could imagine that a lot of these tariffs are going to go away. That Trump is going to say, okay, they accomplished their objectives and we're going to get rid of them in the run-up to the election, right? It's a sort of old, long-standing pattern that politicians try and prime the pump of the economy in the run-up to elections. So this one way would be to say, we accomplished all of our objectives, we're going to get rid of the tariffs, and that takes us a little bit back, per the caller's question, to where we were, you know, say a year and a half ago.
Mark, thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much.
Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us today to talk about recent analysis of the impact that tariffs implemented by the Trump administration are having on American consumers. Governor Tony Evers says the state's contract with Foxconn should be renegotiated after the electronics manufacturer switched gears on its proposed plant in the suburban Milwaukee area. The Taiwan-based company announced earlier this year that it was revising its plans for the Mount Pleasant facility and would build smaller television screens, as opposed to its original plan to build large panel displays. Governor Evers says the company's decision to have a smaller footprint likely means Foxconn will fall short of the promised 13,000 jobs it was supposed to create.
Clearly, the deal that was struck is no longer in play. And so we will be working with individuals at Foxconn, and of course, with WEDC to figure out how a new set of parameters should be negotiated.
Not surprisingly, Republicans at the state capitol have pushed back on the governor's statement. Laura White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
So how would you assess the mood and temperature at the capitol over this news?
Well, I think it's safe to say that it's a pretty contentious mood right now. Republican leaders really aren't happy with Governor Evers for these comments. They say that he's undermining the Foxconn deal, that this is something that they've been worried about him doing from day one, that it sort of sends a bad message to potential investors that, you know, might be doing things surrounding the Foxconn deal as it kind of, you know, ramps up and gets off the ground in southeastern Wisconsin. They're certainly not sending signals that they're willing to go down this path that the governor kind of set up yesterday.
And talking to reporters, Governor Evers said that the circumstances surrounding the deal have changed. Here's what he said.
The present contract deals with a situation that no longer exists. So it's our goal to make sure that the taxpayers are protected and environmental standards are protected. And we believe that we need to take a look at that contract and see if it needs to be downsized as a result.
Laura, from the governor and his administration's perspective, what are they taking issue with Foxconn's potential change in plans and the resulting job growth?
So basically what's happening with Foxconn is that they have they've confirmed that they are downsizing the facility that they are going to construct in southeastern Wisconsin. So this original contract that was negotiated when Governor Walker was still in office, of course, was for what they call a Generation 10 facility. Foxconn has confirmed that they will be not moving forward with that facility, but rather building a Generation 6 facility. The difference there is that they won't be building these large screen panels as originally anticipated. They're going to be doing kind of smaller screens. There are a whole number of supply chain reasons for that, but the bottom line is the facility is going to be producing a smaller product, and the Evers administration says, you know, the product line has changed, the size of the facility, the type of the facility has changed, and that should, you know, necessitate kind of a revisiting of this original contract because, you know, as we heard him say in the soundbite, it's not the same deal that was struck before. So he just wants to take another look at things.
Has Governor Evers given any specifics on what points of this agreement he would like to see renegotiated?
He hasn't. Reporters asked him that yesterday. You know, Governor, what would you be looking to renegotiate here? He didn't have any, specific ideas there. He said it was premature to talk about that. But he did say that he just wants to make sure that the public is aware of what's going on and that there are protections that are sufficient for taxpayers and for the environment as the company moves forward.
We're talking with WPR's state capitol reporter Laurel White about Governor Evers' announcement that he wants to pursue renegotiating the contract with Foxconn. And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said WEDIC negotiated an ironclad contract. Laurel, is that accurate? And if it is, does it mean there's not much room to negotiate?
Well, you know, this was something that came up a lot during the gubernatorial campaign. There were different views from different Democratic candidates over how ironclad the contract with Foxconn is. Some of the Democratic candidates said that the state could back out of the deal entirely. Others said it could be renegotiated. Interestingly, Governor Evers, though he was critical of the Foxconn deal during his campaign, wasn't pushing for that renegotiation, until just this week, in light of these supply product changes. So it's interesting to see kind of how he's evolved on that. I think clearly a renegotiation would require buy-in from the board of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Assembly Speaker Voss has said he thinks it's very, very, very unlikely that the board of that corporation would sign on to any sort of changes to the deal, because there's a perception from Republican leaders that do have the majority of appointments on that board right now that any changes would weaken the deal.
Laurel, has there been any response from Foxconn in relation to this statement by Governor Evers?
Mm-hmm. So Foxconn put out a statement this morning. It said that the company remains committed to its contract with the state of Wisconsin. They pointed out that they've been in continual contact with Governor Evers' administration and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. They said that they are, quote, open to further consultation, collaboration, and new ideas. So it seems like, you know, they kind of want to keep that line of communication open, at least in this, you know, public official statement.
It would seem that anything on this scale might need to be tweaked as it goes along. Have you gotten any sense of whether this is really that surprising a position to stake out?
Well, you know, that's really something that a lot of folks have pointed out as Foxconn has gone through these changes. You know, the first reports came in January that Foxconn might be changing the type of facility that it was building in Wisconsin. There was first kind of the murmurings that they wouldn't be making these large screens. Then there were some reports that they weren't going to be making screens at all. Then we've come back to, which the company has confirmed, these smaller screens. So as those kind of developments have occurred, people have pointed out this is the way business works. The market changes. There were those supply chain issues about getting the large panes of glass to Wisconsin, as would be necessary for manufacturing. So for a lot of folks, they say, you know, this is to be expected. This is how things work, and there needs to be kind of an inherent flexibility on all parties involved as things move forward.
Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said in a statement that this move on the part of Governor Evers confirms Republicans' belief that the governor wants to undermine the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And is this, where do the Republicans fall? Would they rather be right, or would they rather see the Foxconn deal go through as is?
They definitely want to keep the Foxconn deal as is. I think the statements from Senator Fitzgerald and Speaker Voss are pretty clear that they think the deal is a good one. They think it has sufficient protections for taxpayers, and that any sort of going in and fiddling around with the contract as it is written and as it was agreed upon would just weaken it and send the wrong message, frankly, to the various stakeholders and sort of onlookers. They've talked not only about the businesses that might interact with Foxconn in some way, but also other companies that might consider moving to Wisconsin and engaging in this sort of conversation about economic incentives and development. They said, if we renege on this deal, what kind of message does that send to other companies that might want to come here in the future?
Well, Laurel, thanks for keeping us up to date on this important issue.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us today to talk about Governor Evers' call to renegotiate the deal with Taiwan-based electronics company Foxconn. Foxconn says they are still committed to working and setting up a manufacturing plant in Wisconsin, and Republican legislators want to see the deal as initially negotiated go through in the future. With warmer weather, a lot of insects seem to be appearing inside and outdoors. Where do those little ants come from? That we aren't completely overrun with insects seems to be thanks to how much spiders eat. It turns out they eat a lot. New research calculates that spiders around the world eat between 440 and 882 million tons of prey annually. That's pretty impressive, since the combined weight of all the world's spiders would be about 25 million tons. That means that each spider is eating 17 to 35 times its own body weight a year. So putting that in human terms, that's the equivalent of a 150-pound human being eating over 2,600 pounds of food a year, or over 7 pounds a day. Speaking of humans and hungry spiders, the same researchers did the math, because why wouldn't they, and figured out that the combined weight of all humans is about 316 million tons, well under what spiders are eating in a single year. Lucky for us, they seem to prefer insects like flies and mosquitoes, but you might just want to make sure they have plenty to snack on in your home and garden. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.